Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the June 7th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. This is a special Radio Free California.
Super early.
It's not super early. Dear God, it's 8:45 in the morning.
I pulled a Bonson, and I was up at 4 o'clock this morning to prep for this, because I was mentioning to you offline that I poked my eyeball in the garden, and I got to go to see a eyeball doctor yesterday.
By the way, who'd you see? Can you say?
He was recommended by my primary care guy. His name is Dr. Yom Tube, up in Orange. Really great guy, and said, yep, you've scratched your cornea on a non-toxic plant. By the way, word to our listeners, do not get the sap of a fig tree in your eyes. Apparently, it can cause blindness.
In my 20s, I did that all the time, what I'm saying.
Yes, frogs, toads. And yeah, so anyway, I'm so sorry. I didn't get to this thing yesterday until very early this morning, but there's so much to talk about. We could go right off the top of our
noggins.
It's
going to be hard for me to do this without all the normal preparation.
Yes.
But the reason I say it's special is because we are sitting here in the studio together in my Newport Beach office, and we will not be back here in person together until the very last week of July.
So this is bittersweet.
Special. Well, and I don't even know that you'll be available the last week of July. I know I'll be available. I'll be back in California, but I will be out in the world's greatest city. I'm actually going to be going out to New York City this afternoon, and then I have a week there, and then I'll be in the Hamptons for a week. Then I'll be with you at Acton Institute in Grand Rapids for a week.
We can record there now.
Then I'll be in New York a couple of days. We can record in Grand Rapids, and then I'll be in the Hamptons a few weeks, and then I speak at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas.
Oh, my gosh. I want to go.
Then I go back to the Hamptons. Then I'll be out there for another week, and then I'll be back in California. So that's 7 weeks total with a little back and forth of the city and our summer house in the Hamptons and the travel I have for business. But my point is that I cannot wait to get to New York. I hate New York in the summer with the humidity and all that.
Yeah, it smells like pee.
But I'm telling you, I'm hungry. Because I really...
You're literally talking about food, right?
Well, yeah, but also just there... I really don't get depressed much. I try to stay in a good mood every day. I sometimes get... might seem to other people like I'm kind of cranky, but it's not that. It's really just that I'm very busy and focused. But I don't really get depressed. But I've been in Newport a lot lately, and I am just California is such a great state to look at. But I'm just telling you, there is an energy and an ambition in New York that is, I just miss it when I'm gone.
Well, you just haven't been to L.A. lately.
No, it's real ambitious. Real ambitious.
Did you know that the Summit of the Americas is meeting right now in Los Angeles, down at the Convention Center, I think? The Convention of the Americas is supposed to be this massive, Summit of the Americas is supposed to be this massive convention of Western Hemisphere states, Latin America, Mexico, Central America, Canada, U.S., loads of lefties not showing up. I don't think I even put this much in the show notes, except at the top that the headline from one of the stories is VP Harris looks to show her clout at Summit of the Americas in L.A. This story is mostly a generous critique of her failed performance, because as the reporter says, she was given the impossible task of dealing with Central American, the immigration portfolio, the illegal immigration portfolio. And as the story reports, the economies of much of the Southern Hemisphere in Latin America in general, just terrible. I mean, corrupt governments, military takeovers, state-managed economies from left and right, and a lot of offense taken by lefties, like Lopez Amard. What is his name? I always forget. AMLO is the only thing I can remember, is the Mexican president. Here we go. Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's a lefty. He's upset because the Venezuelans and Cubans weren't invited. Other officials who have taken umbrage at Kamala Harris's talk about Latin America as a really corrupt place where government corruption is the biggest problem challenging these economies, that generates all this immigration. They're upset at her because she's condescending and won't be lectured to by an American, but they sure as heck want Biden's $4 billion aid package, which is tied up right now in the Congress. And given what Harris says about the problems of corruption, why would you want to pour $4 billion into aid packages in many of these countries? It's just, it is a difficult problem. And I really do want to ask you, like, let's just change positions. You're suddenly in the VP seat. You're running this Summit of the Americas.
First of all, I will never be in the VP seat.
No.
President or nothing.
I was going to say, not enough.
But I don't want to be elected. Gerald Ford or nothing. You got to actually pick me to do it.
Remember, Ford was at least a VP first and served like
100. No, but not elected.
No. Spiro Agnew resigned. Oh, my gosh, of course.
And Nixon got to select someone. He had four congressmen, and he picked Gerald Ford.
That's right.
And so Gerald Ford was never elected. He was VP on an under ticket or president.
That's right. And where is Mr. Ford's presidential library? It is in, or museum is in Grand Rapids, which is the home of.
And it's the Gerald Ford Airport and so forth. It's funny. I spent a lot of time in Grand Rapids because of Acton. And then, of course, I have a house out in Rancho Mirage, which is where Betty and Gerald retired. And so I have kind of a footprint of, or a, like a residue of Gerald Ford all over the place. Hmm. Fine man.
Is that, do you use a black light to see all that residue?
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, let's skip it.
I think that he's a fine man, but I'm just was pointing out he was never elected, which I think sounds like the greatest way. And then he did try to run in 76 and tried to run in 80. And I think that campaigning for president sounds like the most miserable experience on God's green earth.
Given Betty Ford, like there's a great new, and I really mean this, I have found it very compelling, even though it is really political, a series right now, I think it's HBO, it's called First Ladies. Have you heard about this? Betty Ford is one of
I've watched the whole thing.
Have you really?
Yes.
What'd you think? I'm
very impressed. Well done. Look, I don't, I one comment is just so inappropriate, but I'm just going to share it.
Sure.
You know, Betty Ford is a just heroic woman and an amazing story. I'm not sure that, like, Michelle Pfeiffer was the right
pick for that.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm just, okay. And then actually, Viola Davis, I think it is, has gotten criticism in her portrayal of Michelle Obama.
That's right.
And in that sense, I think she kind of overplayed her and whatnot, and the resemblance is different. The Eleanor Roosevelt one is probably pretty well cast. Mm-hmm, it was very well acted. Mm-hmm. But, like, the problem with Michelle Pfeiffer is she's such a strikingly beautiful woman that you can't help but then have that be part of the kind of... I'm sure they could use makeup and things to really ugly her down, and that, they don't need to. Betty Ford was an ugly woman. I'm not saying that. But, I mean, I'm saying that all of a sudden now glamour... Right. becomes part of this thing because of Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes.
And Betty Ford was a more, I think, plainly spoken, you know.
She was very Midwestern.
Yeah.
And she struck me.
I didn't know the story about her having been married before to this abusive husband.
Yeah.
And a woman leaving an abusive husband in the 40s, you know, that
big
was
deal.
Unheard of.
And then really remarrying.
Yeah.
I mean, that was also problematic. Yeah, she's a kind of a come-from-behind person. She's very Midwestern, very salt of the earth. My parents loved the Fords. I can remember them finally agreeing after the tumultuous Nixon years and McGovern and... you know, war in Vietnam, and all of a sudden Ford comes in and kind of settles things down. There's the big pardon of Richard Nixon, of course, but Betty Ford just was a real, I would call her a country club Republican. That's how she seemed to me, and maybe that's just because I saw her through the prism of my parents. But, you know, pro-choice at a time when it's really important to remember historically, like the series tries to make something of the pro-choice thing. They talk a lot about her addiction and alcohol problems. But her pro-choice thing, I think, is overplayed because at the time, pro-choice meant a fairly limited right of abortion access. I mean, it wasn't just like, you know, the
Oh, but I have another take on it.
Please.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the unelected people that are married to elected people's opinions on much of anything.
But that's the whole premise of the series, right? It's that all these powerful women shaped the presidency.
The difference is that with Betty Ford, her impact was post-presidency. Now, she would not have been Betty Ford to launch the world's most renowned drug and alcohol rehabilitation facility without that platform. But no, I don't think they're talking about her influence. I mean, Gerald Ford didn't have enough time to have an influence. He was in president for 2 years. I think it was her that it, what she did after getting clean and sober. Michelle Obama's thing is obviously that role in the White House, and their kind of shtick there was, what do you do here? You have kind of two people that both could be president.
That's right.
And I went with him instead of her. Right. And so, you know, I got my own take on that. The Eleanor Roosevelt thing was more, they were willing to play her as a victim, which a lot of historical records are not, because FDR is so deified by the left. But he was a real a-hole.
Yes.
And so they were willing to kind of call that out, the serial adultery and just the broken promises and the impact it had on her. But no, I guess with Betty, I think they played it differently. But yeah, okay, I take for granted... she was pro-choice in a very limited context, and her opinions would not be mine on the issue. I just am shocked that I would be supposed to care what a congressman's wife thinks about a particular issue.
Okay, so you have been designated the VP to fill in for a dead or dying or incompetent or criminal VP.
Well, it's kind of hard to think of there hypothetically being a dead, dying, or incompetent president.
Can't be.
But let's just say there was, and they asked me to be VP.
That's right. Okay, so now you're running Summit of the Americas, and you're in Los Angeles, and you're talking to, really, you're almost talking over the heads of the attendees, which is always part of this deal. It's like Newsom has already, Gavin Newsom has already used this for his own performative, you know, his own peculiar theater to welcome everybody to California and to say what he always says, which is California is a leader in the world. And if you guys would just do what we do here, then everything would be okay. Now, he is clearly not a frequent listener to Radio Free California, but all those others of us who talk here, we know what the governor is all about and we know what the failed policies look like. But he is endorsing California as a model for all these other really kind of mostly broken or neutral. And I shouldn't say that in some kind of grand way. I think that, you know, that unfairly tarnishes some places like Costa Rica, which still stands out to me as kind of a marvel. And I'm sure we'll get loads of email on that because a lot of Californians now hang out down there. They've moved beyond Cabo to go all the way down to Costa Rica.
Yeah, and a lot of expats. They have challenges, though. They're not perfect.
Nobody's perfect, right. No. But I've always been intrigued by Costa Rica, so-called Switzerland of Central America. So anyway, you're up there, you're Senator of the Americas. What do you talk about in terms of economics if you're talking directly to them rather than over their heads at California voters?
Well, I talk about the same thing I would talk about in any environment, which is going to be apolitical. And in this case, it's going to be non-domestic in focus. It will be about the wealth of nations. What are the things that these nations can do to become wealthier nations? And it does sound like the context, a lot of the corruption you're referring to that is plaguing some of these countries is residue of the liberation theology.
Yeah, I have in my notes, Michael Novak, liberation theology.
I think that, you want to all, it's not condescending to appeal to first principles. And if you want to Americanize it, you know, like this is what we do better, you know, but my first principles are, this is to me kind of the defining thing, the notion of America as an idea, not merely a geographical territory. The idea is one of a free society, one of free people and free markets that can drive a better collective experience by harnessing what is best of the created person.
So you mentioned liberation theology. I mentioned Michael Novak, who I was introduced to at real length at the Acton Institute. Three or four cheers for those guys. And there is this kind of inherent statism that when you study, sometimes they call it the underdeveloped South or unequal development internationally, the lefty critique that I grew up with in grad school was that this was all about colonialism and imperialism. And when you begin to look more deeply into this colonialism Ottoman imperialism. It's sometimes called Iberian imperialism. That is, you know, whether it's French or primarily Spanish and Portuguese, it's this old statist model. The Spanish and the Portuguese, when they are founding big parts of Latin America, are not really interested in free markets at all. They are confiscatory. They come in, they topple empires, Aztecs, Mayans, Incas, whatever, and then they exploit natural resources and export those back to Spain, which causes a global inflationary cycle, and Spain becomes the sick old man of Western Europe by, what, like 1700s, 1800s, I think. They're almost out of the game. And the statism inherent in these bureaucracies and the land patterns, everything else, is the problem, that we have state structures that keep these countries poor. And I would argue that's where California is trending, not away, you know, not toward liberal democracy, the principles of the West as you've described them, but toward this kind of statism. And so naturally you get liberation theology as the only revolutionary response to that in Central America. Not the only. You have Chile, right, under Allende and the Chicago School. Augusto Pinochet, who comes after Allende. So, I don't know, it's just this whole statist kind of model, and your first principles appeal, I think, is the right one. We will not hear that much, I think, because what's interesting is you've got a bunch of people in this article that I'll post in the show notes who are advisors to Kamala Harris. And among their major concerns is that she really needs to talk more, you know, more aggressively about things. Like, one of them is a woman whose name is unlikely. I didn't have a chance to look it up. Rebecca Bill Chavez. I guess her, I don't know where Bill comes in, but Rebecca, president of the Inter-American Dialogue. She advised Harris on foreign policy during her brief presidential run. And she welcomed the VP's focus on gender-based violence and female migrants, something missing from past administrations. Again, at the most superficial level, of course, we believe in gender equality, but we do not believe that this is, like, at bottom the biggest problem, the root problem of corruption in these statist economies in the South.
Well, I guess I doubt this thing will get a lot of play. I hadn't even heard of it, and other than when Kamala comes into California and screws up my flight plans, I don't think a whole lot of people will care about this. It's interesting they're letting her go. I guess this is kind of a good place. Like, if I'm them, I wouldn't mind putting her there. I don't think there's much.
You mean the Biden administration? Or?
Yeah, hide Kamala there, because I don't think there's much downside. and then upside.
Hide her at a major global conference in L.A.
No, but it's not major to the world.
Not to the world.
It's not yeah, major.
I'm sorry, major.
I know that sounds. It's just not major.
No, it's not. You didn't know about it. Most people don't know about it.
And it's South American, where a lot of people's focus is on Europe and on China.
Right.
Like, it just isn't, yeah.
But, you know, even as this AP story points out, that, you know, the Biden administration has a catastrophe on its hands. It was supposed to reform immigration, which under Trump had been so awful, and all it really did was unleash torrents of new economic and, you know, other kinds of migrants here. And whatever one thinks of that problem at root, it's that people find it better to come to America, which ironically is dismantling the very reasons these people are fleeing to come here. You and I have talked often about Peter Navarro, former econ business professor at UC Irvine here, and then Trump's China.
I always forget about the Orange County connection of this guy.
I know, but
can you believe
he's one of
some
our neighbors.
People that like this guy? Some Trumpians that take this guy. This dude is such an ass clown.
Well, but
you know he was totally hated in the administration.
I did not know that. Tell me.
Oh my! I'm not going to tell you. I just told you what I'm going to tell you.
That's it.
He's
no
hated
more.
In the administration by everyone other than his boss.
Yeah.
Who loves anyone who just tells him everything he wants to hear all the time. Now, look, I'm on Andy McCarthy's side on this. Like, I do not like Pete Navarro, and I think he's an intellectual midget, and I think he's totally wrong on this issue as well as most issues.
This issue being the January 6th stolen election stuff.
Yeah, all that nonsense. But listen, this is so stupid. They're bringing the charges against him for this.
Now, let me just set it up real quickly
for
the listeners.
Such an abuse of the DOJ. Why don't you tell us?
Yeah, so a federal grand jury has indicted Peter Navarro. This is from the National Review story. Has indicted Peter Navarro, a former Trump White House advisor, on criminal contempt
and
of Congress
charges. And cuffed him publicly, did
yes.
the whole thing.
Oh, that was terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, like this is a guy.
A whole perp walk for an 80-year-old UCI professor.
That's right. Now, there's a couple of problems. One is that Navarro's saying he can't testify because the president, former President Trump, has invoked executive privilege. It is not my privilege to waive. But the committee argues, I think sort of impressively and probably correctly, that he's a trade advisor. But he was in the White House on January 6th not talking about trade. He was not there in his capacity as a trade expert. He was there as an advisor to Trump on the stolen election charge. So,
look, it doesn't matter. You know, should he testify? Should he not? What is he going to say? You know, the distinction about what his role was in the White House. The fact of the matter is there's a still being adjudicated legal dispute about whether or not they can act the scope of executive privilege, and the notion of arresting him where they have never done this ever and doing it in that public light. And as Andy McCarthy points out, this is all the while the Garland DOJ is not arresting people that are going to Supreme Court justices'
houses,
yes, threatening violence, protesting, right, in the midst of an open case that, yeah, is before the court.
Right.
And that is black and white explicitly illegal.
They aren't the same, right? These I apologize for maybe being too dumb on this, but these events are very,
as
very
always, I
similar.
Forgive you.
Thank you so much for being an idiot. I appreciate that. Me being the idiot. So these two events, the January 6th stuff, the protests, the pro Roe v. Wade kinds of activists outside Supreme Court, these are both attempts to derail the legitimate exercise of government authority.
Well, the January 6th was for those who broached the Capitol.
Yes.
So, like, I think it's fine for us to say that there were people, and I think as best I can tell, it was most people that were there at that ridiculous protest that day, listening to all the nonsense.
At the rally.
Which was totally their American right, mm-hmm, to go, sure, get riled up and hear dumb stuff from people that are up to no good. But that, you know, there's a line in our country of lawbreaking and like vandalism and trespassing and threatening of police officers.
Beating them up.
And in some cases, literally doing physical violence. Now, I'm fully on board with the idea that it was a very, very small amount of people and that the media has turned this into something like there's basically half the country that are good people and half the country that rioted January 6th.
That's right.
As a guy who's been very critical, always for good reason, of President Trump since he was a candidate, and also, by the way, back when he was just ripping off everyone he ever did business, mm-hmm, with as well. Mm-hmm. People always say, like, why'd you start hating Trump in 2015, man?
Yeah.
And I go, well, actually, I thought the guy was a total charlatan in 1988.
Yeah.
Thanks for paying attention.
Right.
Listen, there is a constitutional right to protest and to an assembly. There is actually not at Supreme Court Justice's house.
Right. That's illegal.
And so for Garland to say we're not going to prosecute that, and they're going to arrest this Pete Navarro guy.
Right.
I am so sick of the left making my job harder. And what I mean by my job is someone who's trying to advocate movement conservatism in a thoughtful, prudent, and respectable manner. Do you understand that they're making a martyr out of Pete Navarro?
Yes.
And the guy's a complete idiot. And they're making a martyr and a hero out of this guy?
Yes.
I mean, what are we doing? Stop it. Don't kick Trump off Twitter. Don't arrest Pete Navarro. Don't run 56 stories. The Atlantic, I read it last night. The Atlantic has like a 10-page story out about Steve Bannon and the grave threat he is to democracy. Mm-hmm. Just stop with this stuff.
Let's move on. Let's talk about shootings a little bit, still sadly in the news. We talked last week about what I think is one of the most important stories that almost nobody has ever read, and maybe some of the people here took us up on our offer to read it in the show notes last week, but the story from CalMatters, Outgunned, Why California's Groundbreaking Firearms Law is Failing. This was the red flag of all red flag systems in America. It's a big database called the Armed and Prohibited Person System. You're supposed to put people in that system who ought to have their guns confiscated, if in fact they have guns. And it is an absolute cluster, 20 years old, numbers increasing all the time in this database, bad information, outmoded technology, lack of coherent cooperation between local and state officials on this thing, people not talking to each other across platforms. It's just a mess. It is a complete cluster. And yet the governor is still out there banging the drum for firearms limitations. And his most recent one is that he's going to spend millions, he says, in a state where the budget just hit about $300 billion. He's going to spend $11 million promoting red flag warnings. And this is going to go to... this is going to go to basically advertising. And how are they going to advertise? It's going to go, all this money, $11 million, is going to be given to local community activist organizations who are going to promote red flag warnings. So it's just one more way in which a party gets into power. In this case, it's obviously the Democrats in California. They get into power. They start turning on the flow of cash, the money pipeline into community activist organizations. And those organizations then go out and do whatever the hell they want, literally. I mean, they will get this money. There will be little accountability. These are my predictions. These are not hot takes. They're based on our analysis of everything that goes on in California. So we're giving $11 million to, for example, here's $5 million to statewide education, including research and multilingual outreach with an emphasis on at-risk communities. This is going to be like trans stuff. And of course, it'll be African Americans and gangs and that sort of thing. Spending $5 million to local domestic violence groups for community outreach, domestic violence. Allocating $1 million to provide education and training for statewide district attorneys and law enforcement groups through an existing San Diego-based program. They don't say what that program is, and I'm sad to say that I did not look it up. But here's what's amazing to me. In Newsom's press release on this, he says, common sense gun laws work. In California, we prove that every single day. Our gun safety laws, banning assault weapons, universal background checks, red flag laws, age restrictions, and waiting periods have cut our state's gun death rate in half since the 1980s. Now, why do you suppose he goes back to the 1980s? Because that would then cover the period during which loads of gunfights were breaking out all over the place, in which case we had rising criminal activity. 1977, when young Will Swaim is 17 years old, is the high point of national youth violence for teenagers. I'm 17 years old. That's when it's going crazy. So through the 80s, into the 90s, and then we get three strikes in California, and the governor wants to claim it's the gun laws that have changed things. No, it's putting people in jail who have a propensity for violence. Three strikes.
This is why post-hoc ergo propter hoc remains one of the most frequent and dangerous logical fallacies, that something happens after it because of it. So saying, well, after the gun laws, you have a responsibility to establish causation. Correlation does not grant you causation. That's right. And so I guess you could say the same about three strike laws. Well, we tightened up gun laws and we tightened up three strikes. And so let's all sit around and debate which one we think caused it.
That's
well, right. I'll tell you right now, it's going to win that debate.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, no, I don't know. It's not a problem. It's political posturing. But on the merits and substantively, if that still matters to anybody, you're exactly right. It's totally disingenuous. What helped eliminate that is the fact that we put the people who were going to use guns dangerously behind bars. And we've had a pickup in gun violence where we've started letting some of these people go, where we can't hold people if they don't steal $950 mm-hmm. of stuff, mm-hmm. where, bail issues. That's going to be the next big thing. Let's see how this DA recall thing goes in mm-hmm. San Francisco.
Today, as we talk, by the way, we're recording Tuesday Election Day morning in California.
Do you think he's going to get recalled?
I do.
I do, too.
Yeah. Especially based on his wild, as we discussed last week, and increasingly feverish claims that he never supported defunding, that he's really quite moderate on these things, and that social justice doesn't mean lack of police enforcement.
Well, so in that case, the people who are for his recall have to make a choice. Do we want to recall him because he said he was going to do a bunch of stuff that was going to increase crime and he did it? Or do we want to recall him because he said he wasn't going to do a bunch of stuff that increased crime but he did it? But him appealing to what his intentions were 2 years ago is a very odd defense.
Yeah.
Because the fact of the matter is that they did do all those things. They have an explosion of crime and drug use and homelessness and danger. It is a perilous place to live. And his policies and inactions are the reason why. I don't understand why him saying, no, if my speeches were moderate, which isn't true,
no.
but how would that help?
Right. You and I are, I think we've established that we're both anti-recall on principle. But I do
think... I'm anti-on governance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's because we have cycles, 2 or 4 years or whatever, to recall people, if you will, at the ballot box during regularly scheduled periodic elections. And in this case, however, I would point out that the failures of a district attorney to prosecute crime in an environment in which property crimes and assaults and violence are way up is the legitimate time for a recall. People's lives are literally at stake. I would have said that, you know, with Gavin Newsom, the big thing for me was not that he was hiding out at the French Laundry so much as the fact that he was doing it at a time when he had shut down and destroyed the California economy and destroyed people's businesses and prohibited them from going to church or school or whatever, with predictable results we see all over the place now, including the fact that here's a headline. I mean, I invite anybody who doesn't just spend as much stupid time on the internet as I do to just take a moment and just key in like California murder rate and just look for some stories. The first one that popped up for me that I thought was fun was fun. Sorry. Here's the LA Times from about a month ago. Killings in LA are on pace to top last year's high. That would follow last year's high was the highest on record in like 15 years for murders.
So where was the high in the 80s? Was it 89?
Yeah, 88, 89 is really
so,
high.
So we know what was going on then because you and I were right in the center of the LA rap wars.
Yes, you and I both, yeah.
And so, just, you know, as those things sprawled down from South Central to Irvine,
yes,
I remember like it was yesterday in the basketball courts of Woodbridge,
straight out of Woodbridge.
This was no joke. But think about that. Right now we're talking about the shootings up in L.A. and those gangs have more or less been out of the paper. Now you had a East Coast West Coast thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people were really coming from East Coast to shoot people on the West Coast in the 90s. But as far as intra-city violence, like there was a whole movement around the hatred the Crips and the Bloods mm-hmm. had for each other. And now we're going to try to get our violence data back up to that level.
Right.
I mean, history just repeats itself.
It really does. And so this, you know, I only point out the LA Times story because in part Newsom is fired up about mass shootings, which frequently are not mass in the sense, like there was a shooting recently, and I'm blanking on where this was just recently, maybe Tulsa or something, where a bunch of guys got into a shootout with each other and killed a bunch of innocent people too. And the media immediately called that a mass shooting, as if somebody had walked into a crowded place, like the guy up in, you know, Las Vegas at the whatever that was hotel and started shooting at people at a country music festival a couple of years ago. That's a mass shooting. Walking into a school and shooting a bunch of people, that's a mass shooting. Gang fights are not, and yet they are politically expedient in terms of labeling the mass shootings, which then the media ties into almost invariably, I would point out, to the problem of guns generally, specifically to white supremacy. That's why the Buffalo shooting was such a gift to the left, because for a minute they were able to just bang the drum about the dangers of white supremacy and Tucker Carlson. And yet in California, here in LA, the people who are shooting black people are black people. This is the big problem. Or Latino people shooting Latino people. This is the problem here. And we have a governor who says, oh, you know, we're winning every day. We prove it. No, every day we prove that California's gun laws are ineffectual, feckless. They do the dangerous thing of persuading the public that we're going to fix this through more gun
laws.
But
see, I've used New York as an example in this case that these are the kinds of issues I wish from the bottom of my heart, Will, that the stuff you're fighting for at CPC were these issues, union reform, pension reform, fiscal responsibility, you know, school choice. But there are some issues that finally make voters that are really, really screwed up say, to hell with it, we're throwing the bums out and starting over. And if they're not going to do it over school choice and pension reform and these issues, then crime generally is one. And that's why I've always commented on the relative pragmatism of New York voters to California, mm-hmm. which has played out several times. And even if Eric Adams proves to be a total goober of a mayor, he only won because he campaigned as someone who would be tough on crime.
Right.
And was a former cop. And you think about 2 years ago, the whole nation lost its mind and said, we need defund police. We need less of this, blah, blah, blah. So then now we look to San Francisco. We're encouraged by those recalls on the school board. We're mm-hmm. looking at this thing with the DA. But then the LA mayoral race. You're going to have two Democrats running against each other. So is the one saying he wants to spend more money on more cops going to win, or is this Karen Bass with Magic Johnson's support going to win by essentially running a borderline squad member? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll see. We'll see. I would love to be wrong. I would love to that they follow the normal path of human evolution here and say, yeah, we don't want to get shot up in our own neighborhoods.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, until San Francisco with the recall, there wasn't a single election there that encouraged me in 30 years. Mm-hmm. Not one.
Yeah.
And so what do you do in a democracy where people are determined to vote themselves into oblivion? I don't think you do anything. I think oblivion has to happen if that's what they're going to do.
Well, this is the thing that has made me most sad over the years as I talk to, you know, donors and reporters and, you know, people who are sympathetic to the kinds of things you and I talk about, who say that the only thing that's going to save California is California's absolute destruction of itself. Yeah. That's when people wake up. The problem is of following that path is that we allow, I think, evil to triumph really in the meantime. It just flourishes. And I'm not saying...
Well, it depends if someone's saying it descriptively or prescriptively. And yes. I don't hear very many people say it prescriptively. No. I would never say it prescriptively.
No.
But yeah. I would say it's a possibility descriptively that the only hope will end up being... a bottoming out. But I hope that's not true. And I don't believe it is. It needs to be true.
But there are bottoms, are there not? Beneath bottoms, like turtles all the way down. This is a challenge where I think, you know, I really look at something like, you know, a Venezuela with tremendous natural wealth and a population of, you know, bright human beings just ground down, and suddenly you've got authoritarianism. And I'm not saying that California is Venezuela. Thank God for the rest of America hemming us in to some extent. But we've got a system of government in which virtually every major function of business is now heavily regulated by the government and driven by the government towards ends it wants, whether it's gender equity on corporate boards or the marginally represented on in school curricula. The Assembly Bill 5, which attempted to basically destroy the business models of the gig economy and took down loads of just small-time freelancers, photographers, graphic designers, translators, dance instructors, you name it, people who had no business being monitored by the government.
This is why I want to – I'm sorry. I should let you finish.
No, I'm done.
I really think there's a big distinction between these economic issues and things that are pro-prosperity and things that are anti-prosperity. Things like ridiculous high marginal tax rates, overregulation,
yes.
Because they still do have a block the benefits. It's still special interest voting.
Yes,
the anti-business reality of that AB5 did not lack a constituency that liked it. So appealing to Marxian class struggle as the great social anxiety in the state is not going to go away. That is a way to win elections. Mm-hmm. I'm referring to the thing that finally cuts through it. Who are the voters in favor of death, violence, and destruction?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's why crime... I'm just being kind of like a prophet here. A pastor.
I love it.
But I'm neither. I'm neither a prophet.
Talk to me, Reverend Bonson.
Is a state worth saving if economic prosperity, economic fairness, market justice, school choice, education, freedom, and a health pandemic, if all of those things are not enough to animate people, the only thing that will maybe get you to vote right is if everyone's getting shot?
Mm-hmm.
Is it already lost?
Descriptive. Okay, so last week as we were recording, the report was coming out from the California Reparations Committee. They had their big study out.
I'm sorry.
Please.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Because we're moving on past Is Caruso going to win in November? It will be Caruso and Bass,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
Obviously.
And Caruso was until recently a Republican.
Well, it's been a while, I think.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of years, right?
Oh, I thought it'd been more.
Oh, maybe so. In any case... Caruso over Bass, from your lips to God's ears. Here's the interesting thing about Karen Bass that, you know, you appropriately talk about her social justice flag waving. The fact is that beneath that, we talked about on this podcast a few times, that she, while in Congress, she has been promoting a bill that would have required unionization of police departments everywhere in the country because it has worked so marvelously here in California. And of course, this is the Democrats' money machine. Just really quickly, I've talked about this before in my own personal experience on it. And that is, liberals are in control of governments, and therefore police, firefighters, all other unions support those liberals. Even though the rank and file members of cops and firefighters tend to be conservative by polling, we know that their unions back extraordinarily left-wing candidates because those are the people in power. So you support them. You give them all kinds of money to go out and beat up the Republicans who, like, say, John Warlock or Kevin Kiley or Brian Dolley, who's running for governor against Newsom, and Michael Schellenberger. We've talked about them. But you use this money as a union to get people in positions of power so they will give you more money. Well, Republicans are not in the business, we hope to God, of just expanding the size and scope and power of government unions. But Democrats are. And then the Democrats get to go out and get their picture taken as candidates with cops, with firefighters, with teachers, and say, look at me, I have the support of all right-thinking people. The cops are going to protect you, the firefighters who rush into your home heroically, the teachers who love our children so much. You get those pictures, you run, you win, you get into office, and then you rubber stamp whatever the union wants. That's how Karen Bass got into Congress, was working the police unions. So Bass now gets to say that all other states in the nation, no matter what they think about unions and right to work, they all have to have police unions. Why? Because that's what the police unions want. They want this nationally. That's their big play here. Then George Floyd is murdered in Minneapolis, and Bass quietly hides the bill. Just puts it. She doesn't kill it. She just kind of pulls it from consideration temporarily. And she would like all of the activists since the summer of 2020 to forget that she was backing increased union protections of bad cops like Derek Chauvin, who kills George Floyd. So that's who Karen Bass really is. You know, huge surprise. She has no solution on homelessness. Caruso, we can hope, is a developer and a common sense business guy. He is not crazy. You may actually know Rick Caruso. Is that right?
I've met him, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know him well, but I've met him actually a couple times.
Strikes me from his statements. I don't know him well either. Strikes me from his statements as a guy who's really just kind of into a almost technocratic kind of like Dick Reardon, who used to run LA. Yeah. You know, a business guy who steps kind of,
or
in.
Or a Bloomberg. In a lot of ways.
A Bloomberg, yeah. Right.
With just a lot less money.
Yeah. So I hope so. I hope that it's Caruso v. Bass, and I hope we get the thorough debate we need over the first principles. I don't know that Rick Caruso is a first principles guy, but that's not how you win elections in terms of your rhetoric or messaging. It's how you orient your campaign. The messaging comes later.
Well, just like Eric Adams in New York, I don't think that the real issue here is them winning or not winning. It's not the what will happen. It's what it signifies in the election itself. Eric Adams beating those de Blasio Marxists was at least a reflection of the fact that the people were picking something marginally and directionally better than what you would have thought is the more in vogue progressive radicalization. I think that Caruso could end up letting us down or not letting us down, but marginally the takeaway for me would just be the news would not be how he governs, it would be that he won.
Yeah, and then in news closer to my home, my colleague at California Policy Center, Lance Christensen, is running for superintendent of public instruction in California. He's running against the incumbent, Tony Thurmond, who is, you know, a corrupt, miserable, a manager who was a no-show during COVID, who did almost nothing. And all of the endorsements, we've talked about this from the major media, San Francisco Chronicle or the LA Times, say, yeah, he's lousy, but he might be learning on the job. And, you know, this is no time for changing horses. We're in midstream. Let's keep him on the job. The San Diego Union Tribune, among major newspapers in the state, came out and endorsed Lance as superintendent of public instruction. It's too late by the time people listen to this show to make any difference in the election outcome or voting or anything like that. But I do think there's an outside chance Lance comes in second. He was endorsed by the Republican Party. He is a guy for school choice. Every mention of him in endorsements of Tony Thurmond point out that Lance is for school choice. The Chronicle said that's just a non-starter. But he's actually a really smart guy, the Chronicle conceded. Well, the Union Tribune went farther and said, we need a radical recentering of public education on the needs of students and their families. that that, not the teachers union, which support Thurmond, that's the distinction here. So again, I hope that we might get a vibrant debate. I don't know. It's very likely in a race like this one that two Democrats come out and Tony Thurmond cleans their clocks. But anyway, there it is. Big reparations study out. There's a good overview of the issues, not so much an analysis, but just sort of the headline is five takeaways from the reparations study. And we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, David, because I think it underpins most. This reparation study is exactly what you would predict out of a very woke initiative. This is an attempt to argue that people in California who are the descendants of slaves have suffered more in California than all other groups of people who came here, including my nine-fingered, nearly deaf grandfather who arrived here at the age of 17 and slept in a shipyard while working on ships, fell from the top of a ship and broke his back on the keel of a ship under construction in San Pedro Harbor, couldn't afford to go to a doctor. This is a kid who didn't finish the eighth grade and comes to America, settles in California, was on his way to Australia and just couldn't keep going, had no money. So he just stalled out here and then became a fairly successful business owner, very successful, I would argue, and sent his kids to college and befriended the Reagans at a country club. I think they were at Bel Air together. Loved Ronald Reagan and could not understand my affection either for the left or for England, but he loved me anyway. What a great guy.
Love it.
So this is a place where immigrants used to be able to come and do amazing things. And they still can on the margins, but this is a state that primarily believes in focusing on this other, I would argue, more marginal, because I've only read parts of this massive, it's like 500 pages, David, and I was trying to read just for the history. And the analysis is that they could kind of cherry pick a few things from the 1850s that happened in California, like California had the sort of slave repatriation stuff that was, you know, then the national conceit in the 1850s, like, hey, we're not pro-slavery, but if a slave escapes in California, we are going to return him. That didn't happen. It wasn't universally imposed. We've talked about it in the show, how in the 1850s, you've got local county sheriffs going out and freeing people who'd been brought here as slaves. So it's a much more nuanced story than this reparations committee would have us believe. But their goal is to say California is systemically racist. And what we really need now is to double down on reparations payments of a sort. Like, hey, did you know that our schools are segregated really heavily? We need to desegregate our schools and give our kids a better opportunity. Well, what does desegregation look like? How about school choice? Can't have that. Why? Because a teachers union does not want school choice. School choice would put money in the hands of people to send their kids to schools.
Well, no, but you're adding another dimension to it that you're 100% right about. But I think if they were to come out with this and then we were to say, well, we believe that if one is actually interested in some sort of racial justice in 2022, the school choice would be at the top of their list. And then they say, no, we're not going to do it. We go, it's because you're in bed with the unions. Then we're right. But it would be a different element than what this seeks out to do.
Oh, yes.
I don't need to bring union politics in to make this point. You do not care about racial equity and justice. You're lying.
That's right.
And the reason I know that is you just got done doing a huge report about what you consider to be elements of systemic problems along the lines of race in our state. And the most prominent and obvious and needle-moving measure is nowhere in your report. So we can let's do this. I will let you bring up the issue of reparations, where people who didn't do anything wrong pay money to people who may or may not have been indirectly affected, because some, I will grant, were indirectly and some were most certainly not. But what, as I mentioned last week, my point is on the other side of the equation. There are some people who were affected by the bad things of 150 years ago still today. There are no people who were guilty of it.
Mm-hmm.
None. So you don't have someone who is culpable carrying the tag.
But we are culpable, if you're a leftist, we're culpable by our privilege, right? Our privilege is itself an ongoing crime.
Well, yeah, but this is the problem, you have to assume the conclusion before you bring in the premise. Is the privilege the byproduct of race? And then what is the counterfactual? Mm-hmm. It does seem to me there's some poor white people in parts of the state
yes.
that might therefore be able to make an argument that they didn't pick up that privilege gene in their color.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's my question. Why not just start with what we can do to improve racial issues and economic oppression, underprivilege today, such as the fact that some people are doomed to terrible schools and other people have an opportunity to go to better schools? Let's just start there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what kind of difference that makes. And then if we still think it's not doing enough and you want to bring back up this reparation thing and that still seems to kind of be hip on TikTok or whatever, then we'll cover that. We'll yeah. look at that in a few years.
Well, I would show, I mean, this is, you know, maybe too deep in the weeds, but every analysis I've seen shows that just take one example, the Alliance Charter Schools, interest of full disclosure, one of our board members, Dale Acuno, is on the board of the Alliance Charter Schools. The Alliance Charter Schools send north of 90% of their charter school graduates to four-year universities, four-year, not community college, directly into four-year universities, over 90%. Meanwhile, schools in their same neighborhoods send fewer than 10% to four-year universities. Same neighborhoods, same general demographic population, and yet one of them succeeds, the other one does not, and it was all about this moment, this little opportunity of parent choice. Some parent somewhere said, I'm not sending my kid to this violence-plagued, woke school that will not educate my children. I'm sending them one that I hope will be better. So there's that. We could talk about there are the five takeaways here that we've got a problem of sort of, I would argue, state-sponsored stuff in the particularly in the 1850s. State-sponsored apartheid undoubtedly existed in the state in some small places in some small ways. Criminal justice disparities. It tries to argue that though the black population is just 5.6%, the fact that 28.5% of California's male prison population is black, is that disparity is outrageous. And yet we just got finished talking about the murder rate in LA, where lots of black people are being killed by other black people, or lots of Latino people being killed by other Latino people. This is a problem in their community, and yet we're supposed to solve this somehow by making sure that people don't go into prison again, which we've already established, I think, produces more violence. Political disenfranchisement. Again, they have to go back to the 1850s for their evidence of political disenfranchisement. Separate and unequal education. They talk about the problem of segregation in schools. I just mentioned that. We talked about it. Housing segregation and health. Did you know that poor people, which will include black people, tend to live in places that are not as desirable as wealthier people? Huge shock. Wealth gap, that government policies, here it says, government policies that supported enslavement have helped white Americans accumulate wealth. This is the privilege argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
While creating barriers preventing black Americans. What's the answer to this? We need a Freedmen's Business Affairs office in California to provide ongoing education related to entrepreneurship and financial literacy, business grants, and new public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
How about just better education? And no violence in black communities. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Amen.
Okay. I wanted to talk just real quickly, David. How much time do you have, brother? Okay. Let's just talk real quickly then about just a couple of things here. I'm going to skip down to the problem of unions here. This is my day job. I talk about this all the time. So what's fascinating to me here is...
oh, by the way, just as we're talking, just got breaking news of... a terrorist firebomb at a pro-life pregnancy center. Some pro-aborts have firebombed a pro-life pregnancy center.
Where's that?
In Buffalo.
No kidding. Huh. So these are pro-life centers where they try to give real counseling to people who are pregnant, to women who are pregnant, and talk to them about options for them other than abortion. And you're saying one in Buffalo got bombed
by pro-abortion advocates.
I would say this is probably relying heavily on this is an MSNBC problem. Where's the drumbeat going to start in the media? We got to start talking about the problem of this violence being encouraged by the left. That's going to be surely at the top of the fold in the Washington Post.
We're also going to need some new restrictions against firebombs.
Yeah. Yes. Fire. I think fire is the problem.
I'd like a background check on those that you... to buy a fireball.
That's right. Or matches. So a couple of quick stories in the union thing. I'll start with my favorite story was by Mike Antonucci, who, if you don't know him, is just one of the best union reporters in education around. He writes for the 74 million. That's the estimate of the number of kids who are K-12 aged in America, 74 million. And he somehow has wonderful access to the CTA's internal documents and got hold of their finances. They anticipate losing 4,000 members. Shout out to my buddies at California Policy Center who run the teacher opt-out program. If you know a teacher, love a teacher, are a teacher, contact California Policy Center. You can go right to our website, click on the opt-out, the Janus project there. The Janus decision is the referent, and we can help teachers opt out. And we've been doing that all over California. And thanks also to our donors who fund that effort. I'm not ashamed to say that we have a few very generous people who really support our work to get teachers. This is like the Underground Railroad. Seriously, to get these teachers out of their union is very difficult. The unions make it almost impossible. They harass these people if they leave the union or even express an interest in leaving it. 4,000 members, the union predicts they're going to lose. But they will gain $2.3 million through a number of kinds of alternative revenue schemes. So this is good news. I mean, the less money, the fewer members these unions have to control the political system, the better. The fact that they anticipate a gain in their income, I'm still skeptical about that prediction of theirs. I think it's mostly to head off any kind of internal conflict of the sort that we've seen over at the Service Employees International. And now the California state legislature is contemplating an end to the ban on unions for their staff. And David, I could not be happier than the possibility that unions will organize legislative staff, because I think it will probably lead to the same sorts of efficiencies and corruption inside the state house that have plagued education, public safety, firefighting, and cops. Unionizing staff in the assembly will keep and Senate in Sacramento will keep these people preoccupied with their own personal agenda. We want higher incomes. We don't want to work. It's going to be great. I am delighted by this. So I'll just pop that in the show notes. And then a last quick word here, David. We talked a little bit about Assembly Bill 5 and then Prop 22, which came on right after that, sponsored by Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash, I think it was, a $200 million campaign to exempt themselves, but nobody else, from Assembly Bill 5.
And refresh my memory. You know, obviously, I was against that because of the selectivity and what I believe cronyism of it all the way through. And you said for a while, I know you were for it because it was one step in the right direction. But then did you end up changing?
No, I still said that, look, you know, I think that the challenge you and I were trying to puzzle out was, what do you do when a business, an industrial group, begs for exemption from a law? Yeah. Should we insist
law that is unjust and shouldn't be there?
That's right.
Yeah.
And we hoped for higher principle. We had a number of listeners who wrote in and told us, look, you shouldn't expect business to do for conservatives what we wouldn't want it to do on the left, and that is try to make these big sweeping claims on principle and blow things up. But the businesses are supposed to fight for their own narrow self-interest. They're not supposed to fight for necessarily the wider kinds of applications to other businesses. So you and I agreed on principle that they should be exempt from AB5, but that AB5 was so inherently unconstitutional and deeply flawed and such a union gambit, a gimmick run by the unions to organize gig workers. That's all it was. And so the unions lose on Prop 22, and they immediately go to court and file all kinds of claims, and they win an injunction that seems to briefly overturn Prop 22's victory for Uber and Lyft for their carve out.
And then there was an injunction on the injunction.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so California Policy Center is working. We're building a coalition of folks on the left, folks on the right, because here's what the union's latest play is. They got a state judge to say, you know what? Prop 22 overreached. It allowed voters to step into territory that is completely covered by the legislator. The legislature has sovereignty.
What was that thing that they stepped into that is completely covered by the legislator? The market economy?
Everything.
They stepped into the economy.
That's right.
What are they doing?
Yes, because this California legislature, this judge, this very activist judge whose name is Frank Roche, an Alameda County judge, on August 20th, this is last summer, declared that, okay, Prop 22's got to be overturned. The votes of 10 million Californians who want the overturning of AB 5, at least as it concerns the gig economy, those votes don't count because the legislature has declared itself sovereign. It completely, as my friend Jackson Reese writes in a story that I'll post in the show notes called Californians Are About to Lose Their Voice. Funny headline. Horse race. Like horse, like your voice, you've lost it. Yeah, get the joke. So in this case, we are filing amicus briefs to go to the state appeals court and then ultimately to the state Supreme Court to say, like, look, man, you can't declare the legislature sovereign over the people. That overturns all of democratic principles, small d democratic principles, that the voters are sovereign, not the legislature. And it is absolutely remarkable to me that we have this decision. And yet you're looking at me like I should be shocked to say that it's absolutely remarkable, because I guess it's not remarkable that a state judge would say that the legislature is sovereign. So, David, we could go on. I've got so many other fun stories.
So what's
here,
what's the end run on this thing? Is Prop 22? OK, so they passed AB 5. No. What was the one that
the
22 was responding to?
AB 5.
They passed AB 5. That ruins the current relationship of rideshare.
That's right. By declaring
with their drivers.
Yes, by declaring.
Then they pass 22, which restores the relationship. Then they say, no, it's an injunction against it because 22 is messed up. Then they get an injunction against the injunction, which it was itself an injunction against the original injunction. Now, what I just said is accurate.
Yes,
100%. There was five.
That was good.
Five was to shake things up from status quo.
That's right.
22 was to shake things up from five. Then there was an injunction to shake things up from the shakeup, from the shakeup of the status quo.
Yeah.
Then now there's another injunction of the injunction of the 22 of the five of the thing.
You understand perfectly.
Where is it going next?
Well, next it goes to an appeals court, which is going to look at Alameda Judge Frank Roche's
decision. So it's
going to,
we're going to win the market side of this issue will win in an appeals court.
Wow, really?
I think, well, or in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah.
You have that much faith in the state courts? I love
it. No, I have. Well, I mean, is it going to the Ninth Circuit?
No, it's a state court.
Oh, it's not going to federal court.
No, it's in the states.
Yeah. No, it'll lose there, and then we'll go on.
Okay. Interesting. All right.
In the meantime, by the way, there's just Uber drivers everywhere doing their thing.
Doing their thing, man. All right. Anything else you want to add, Dave, before we head out to go watch election results and do our jobs and you fly back to New York?
We'll let everyone get back to their day. And let's just say after today, it'll be official that the nominee for Congressional District here in Orange County will be our friend Scott Baugh, who will now be in a mano-a-mano race with Katie Porter. That will become official after today's primary. And I just want to say to the 435 people that are members of the House of Representatives, none of you deserve Scott Baugh.
Wow.
And to the 330 million Americans whom Scott Baugh will be representing, none of you deserve Scott Baugh.
He's a great guy. He really is a highly principled, brilliant guy. From your lips to God's ear. Also just a really likable human being. Just one of the most gifted, kind, compassionate human beings and a rock solid, principled guy.
Yep.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for us and you if you just subscribe, because when you do, if you rate and review the show, that helps boost our profile and that helps others find us. Did you get that? Please email us with your comments and story suggestions. Thank you, Dr. Tony Lima, especially, but also all you others out there. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. Follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host Dave Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, whose music you will hear in just a second. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.